Morning, ladies and gentlemen. Our first case for argument, Western Glove Works versus XMH. Mr. Keach.
May it please the court, Robert Keach, counsel to the appellant, Western Glove Works. This appeal arises from the district court's reversal of the bankruptcy court's finding and ruling that a series of agreements between Western Glove Works and the debtor Simply Blue Apparel and its predecessors constitute a trademark licensing agreement that was non-assignable in bankruptcy, specifically to the bankruptcy sale purchasers, the appellees here, without the consent of Western Glove Works. A bankruptcy court decision that this court reviews anew. We believe that the bankruptcy court's decision that the agreement constituted a non-assignable trademark license must be affirmed because, one, the purchasers, appellees, and the debtors no longer here lack standing to appeal the non-assignment order, and the district court erred initially in not dismissing as moot the appeal of the non-assignment order.
I think it would be helpful, at least to me, if you could explain the business purpose of this rather strange agreement where you assign the license, a trademark license for 6 months, well, originally 2 weeks. So we'll start with that, with the 2 weeks. And then after that, the license lapses and is replaced by this service agreement. So what is the purpose of that?
Sure. Actually, Your Honor, we would actually take the position, and we think the document supported that the license here never lapsed, but that the methodology of payment actually changed. And to get to Your Honor's point about the evolution of the business agreement, the initial agreement, which was clearly a short-term license, followed by what was then supposed to be a change in the parties' relationship, was amended by the First Amendment, and we think the First Amendment to the document is the critical one here. The First Amendment to the document then extended the license. I think it's fair to say that the parties were trying each other out initially. And the First Amendment extended the license for the entire course of the agreement. It had a provision, and the critical provision is in the First Amendment, that said that the Seymour J. Blue, then the initial licensee, which became Simply Blue Apparel, would continue to sell as a licensee. For 2 short periods after that, the way that the licensee, Simply Blue, would be paid was based on a percentage of net sales.
Is this the amendment that extended the 2-week license to 6 months, or is this something else?
This is the amendment that extended the license, Your Honor. We would take the position that it wasn't for 6 months.
Well, this is the one, though, that extended the period, at least your
right.
Opposing counsel would say, to June 30th. We just want to make sure we're on the right agreement.
Yeah, we're on the right agreement. We disagree, Your Honor, that it extended the license to June 30th. What the agreement did was extend the license through the course of the contract, as the bankruptcy court found, but dealt with the payment period up through June 30th, and then
right,
referred
what,
to...
What is the language which extends the license beyond 6 months?
Sure. Your Honor, if you look at Section 1.1 of the First Amendment to the agreement...
Well, where is this?
This is in the First Amendment to the agreement, Your Honor, which... I don't have the appendix reference immediately in front of me. But this is the January 1, 2003 First Amendment to the initial agreement.
Okay.
If you bear with me, I can get the appendix reference if you'd like. In Section 1.1...
The document should be in your brief, right?
It's referenced.
Don't make the judges go looking everywhere. When you have a key document, put it in your brief.
Your Honor, this language is quoted extensively in the brief, and I'd be happy to also get the appendix reference if Your Honor would like.
Well, just quote the language
sure.
that supports your theory that it's not a licensing agreement. I mean, that it is a licensing agreement versus a services contract.
Certainly, Your Honor.
And where is that in the brief?
This is in our exegesis of the facts, Your Honor. In the brief, we actually cite to this very provision, and I'll be happy to point that out in the brief. This is Section 1.1 of the First Amendment. And if Your Honor looks at page 9 of the brief.
This is the one that says SJB shall continue to produce and sell trademark apparel as a licensee of WG?
Yes, Your Honor, and it's quoted on page 9 of the brief, and actually the references in the appendix is to pages A1181 and 1182.
But now this just extends to June 30th, doesn't it?
Actually, Your Honor, we believe that's not the case, and that's not also not what the bankruptcy court, we believe, properly found.
And well, if that's you what your agreement says is January 1st, 2003 to June 30th, 2003, in lieu of the arrangement set forth in the agreement with respect to the time period, the following arrangement shall be substituted. SJB shall continue to produce and sell trademarked apparel as a licensee of WG. Well, isn't that... And then it talks about through June 2003. So isn't that the period of the license?
No, Your Honor. And if Your Honor will permit me, I'll explain why. The sentence first, this provision, as the bankruptcy court, we think, properly found, taking into account all the documents, provides that SJB shall continue to produce and sell trademark apparel as a licensee. And then it goes on to talk about the methodology under which the licensee will be paid. And it provides for...
Does it extend beyond June 30th?
Your Honor, the point is it doesn't terminate in this paragraph. This simply says that they will continue as a licensee. It doesn't terminate until the agreement terminates, Your Honor.
When did the agreement terminate?
The agreement eventually was to terminate in 2011 and was active throughout the bankruptcy case.
Where does that say?
Your Honor, is in the letter agreement, which, as I said, this agreement is made up of several agreements that the bankruptcy court was required to look at. And the letter agreement, which is at Appendix 1187, 1188, and is referred to on page 10, provides for the initial terminus of the agreement to be June 30, 2011. It also provides for a number of options to be exercised by the licensee. In one of those cases, they have attempted to exercise that option. But what Section 1.1 provides is that SJB will continue as a licensee. It then provides for specific types of payment for two payment periods. It then goes on to reference back to the prior agreements, although to adjust those dates, to change the methodology of payment. But there is at no point in the series...
That,
Your Honor, would be at... In Section 2, Paragraph 2 of the First Amendment, Your Honor. It is the paragraph referring to time period subsequent to June 30. And in this case, it references back to the prior agreement for the payment methodology. But the license never terminated. What changed in this relationship, and Your Honor asked me early on, I think quite properly, about the purpose of the relationship, and I would be the first to admit that this is not, you know, the ideal way to draft a series of license agreements. But the... fortunately, I can't take either credit or blame, but we certainly would rewrite them if we could. Fortunately, I don't think that's necessary. The reference back here is strictly to payment methodology. And what happened here, Your Honor, was because of the nature of the relationship, a license was absolutely essential to what Simply Blue was doing. It was marketing, it was selling, it was advertising, it was using the JAG logo on a regular basis in all of its activities.
Well, in this, as of July 1... SB no longer had the right to use the license of the JAG trademark, and I think what's critical here, it was no longer obligated to pay a license fee. You agree that was in there. And then it, commencing as of July 1, it was obligated to pay a service fee. So why the difference in the language if the license extended?
Your Honor, this was purely and simply a matter of who was going to handle the money first. The license never terminated, and in fact, in paragraph 2, it does not end the license. It simply changed, and nowhere in paragraph 2 does it say they are no longer able to use the trademark. In fact, it says they will source the sale of trademark apparel. What happened was a change in the way the money was handled. Quite frankly, we wanted to handle the money first and pay them a fee, as opposed to their collecting the money and paying us a royalty. But throughout the relationship, there was a license. The license never expired and could not have expired given the nature of what was being done. Absent the license, Simply Blue could not have performed under this agreement. It could not have used the logo. It could not have sourced and sold and marketed the products. Both parties knew that, and frankly, both parties treated this as a trademark license agreement.
So WGW doesn't sell?
Both parties sell, Your Honor. Mm-hmm. This is not a retail operation. It's a wholesale operation, but both parties sell and source material.
So let me just make sure. On this Second Amendment, nobody refers to license, license fee, royalty, or any kind of that type of fee being paid. It's a service fee. And then in April of 2009, with this letter of intent, where the terms of the agreements were extended, there was no reference to a license or license fee either.
Actually, what it says, Your Honor, is they're going to continue to pay them as they've been paying them. What mm-hmm. it does introduce, which is typical of license arrangements, is a minimum sales provision. They can't exercise the option, and this again goes to the very point I'm talking about with respect to Simply Blue controlling the sales process. The letter agreement imposes for the first time sales minimums in order for them to exercise their options. There's another very important segment of the letter agreement, and again, the bankruptcy court properly considered all of these agreements, and that is the provision for the parties to jointly fund a public relations, advertising, and marketing fund. People who simply are engaged in service arrangements for service fees don't contribute to marketing funds. Licensees contribute to marketing funds and PR and advertising. And if you look at the totality of the agreements, and as we tracked it through in the brief, and again this is in detail on pages 8 through 10, the license, in fact, never terminated. It was originally short-term. It was extended for the entire life of the contract. WGW, as it turned out, prudently and presciently changed the methodology for collecting the money. This company, after all, did end up filing a Chapter 11. So what was going on here was not a termination of the license. The license lasted for the entire term of the contract, as it had to. But what happened was we collected the money and paid them a fee, as opposed to the perhaps more typical arrangement where they would collect money and pay us a royalty. There's nothing about license agreements that requires a royalty. The license agreement is simply a permission extended to use the trademark. That never ended at any point. I think there are two places where the court can go to affirm the bankruptcy court here. The first is that I think these parties have lost standing to appeal.
They're really bad arguments. They're the only parties with an interest. They bought this interest. They have the interest.
Well, Your Honor, I would beg to differ, and with respect, I don't think it's a bad argument. In fact, I think it's a compelling one. This party never appealed. The purchasers, despite having independent standing to appeal.
Because they are now the owners of this. They're the successors.
Well, they were assigned, Your Honor, rights that had already expired.
It's just a technicality. I don't know why you press it so hard. You're arguing to us that Blue remained a licensee, right? That the that's your key issue.
Mm-hmm. Blue remained a licensee throughout the entire period, as the bankruptcy court properly found.
There's this rule, if there is a rule, that a sublicense or license can't be assigned in bankruptcy without the permission of the licensor.
Sure, Your Honor. Section 365C of the bankruptcy court provides that if otherwise applicable law...
What's the reason?
The reason, Your Honor, is the very essence of trademark licenses and the very essence of the protection of the mark. Under the Lanham Act and frankly, all of the federal law protecting both trademarks, copyrights, and patents, the principle is that the licensor, and this is particularly acute in the case of trademarks, gets to choose its licensee. Maintaining the value of a trademark depends upon things like making sure that quality is maintained, making sure...
How about outside of bankruptcy? Could Blue have transferred the license?
Absolutely not, Your Honor. I mean, that's precisely the point.
Bankruptcy is not the issue. It's just the proposition that a trademark license can't be assigned without the licensor's permission.
Correct, Your Honor, but the reason bankruptcy comes into it, as Your Honor knows, typically in what I will call typical executory contracts, notwithstanding anti-assignment language in the contracts, the Bankruptcy Code in Section 365 permits the assignment of contracts notwithstanding an anti-assignment provision, so-called ipso facto clauses. The Bankruptcy Code makes exceptions to its general override of ipso facto clauses or applicable law. And this is such a case. When you have a trademark license, it simply cannot be assigned without the consent of the counterparty, of the licensor in this case. The appellees have cited some outdated law, which has frankly been rendered a dead letter. There were a few cases early on cited in their brief which limited Section 365's exception for applicable law to so-called personal services contracts. This court, in fact, rejected that limitation on the provision in the Midway case. Every court since then has rejected that limitation. And every case that has decided it has ruled that the Lanham Act and otherwise applicable federal law protecting trademarks provides for the non-assignment of these provisions in bankruptcy.
Let me nail down this issue about the nature of the nature of the license. So you say the reason for this change in provision, reconstituting the contract as a service agreement was so that you would be paid directly by buyers rather than getting a fee from Blue? Is that it?
That's correct, Your Honor. This the only fundamental change in this agreement, which continued the license throughout. As I said, otherwise the very basics of the relationship could not exist. The only reason for these changes was to change who handled the money. And the changes all reflect not only who handled the money, but also the manner in which they would be paid. There was an evolution in the methodology of payment from percentages of net sales to another measurement, which then eventually was morphed into the existing one, which is based on gross margin now. But so the manner of the calculation of their payment changed. And what changed was who handled the money and paid the payment.
Okay, well, thank you, Mr. Cooper.
Thank you, Ron.
We'll give you a minute later. Mr. O'Donnell?
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court, Stephen O'Donnell, on behalf of the appellees, the purchasers of the assets of the Hartmarks companies in bankruptcy. With me today are my colleagues, Robin Itkin and Catherine Piper. I'm here to address the issues that the court has shown thus far no interest in, the jurisdictional issue and the standing issue.
Yeah, that's not a great policy in an argument. So let me ask you, what's wrong with this? I have a very simplistic view of this. You have a trademark license, and there are obvious reasons why the licensee should not be permitted to transfer the license. So why not a simple rule? If it says trademark license and you as the licensee want to have the right to transfer the license, you negotiate to have such a provision included. And if you don't, then you can't assign. As simple as that. You don't have to get into what's an implied license, this, that. You know, just use the word. If it says trademark license, you have to have a special provision in order to permit the assignment of the license. But there's nothing unlawful about such a provision. It's just a matter of what the parties want. That would dissolve the case very nicely. So what's wrong with that?
I take your point, Your Honor. Not to step on my colleague's toes, is going to address the substantive issues regarding the contract, but I would suggest that it's equally a good suggestion to state in the contract that there shall be no assignment, which you see in contracts.
It's very valuable to have default rules in contracts so that people don't spend a lot of time negotiating. So it's a simple rule, says trademark licenses are not assignable unless there's a provision which says it can be assigned. That's the simplest in the world, right? And you just put that in, and you got no problems, no litigation, nothing.
Put it in the contract prohibiting assignment. I would agree with you that then it's crystal clear. The courts are split, though, and my colleague will address that.
That doesn't make any sense. Look, the simplest rule is if it's a trademark license, it can't be assigned. If you want to make it, if you want it to assign it as licensee, you say to the licensor, "I want to assign this." And the licensor might say, "Well, I'm not happy with that because you might assign it to someone who would not maintain quality in my trademark, and that would be a disaster. I'd lose the trademark." So it's a perfectly the anti-assignment rule is a perfectly sensible default rule. But there may be special circumstances where assignment is appropriate, and then you negotiate for that.
Mr. O'Donnell, before you answer, this is not really your area, is it?
No, it's my colleague is
so
going to
address. So would you feel more
issues.
Comfortable having Ms. Itkin respond?
Yes,
Your Honor. Because you're just doing the standing issue. I just wanted to...
And the jurisdictional issue,
right.
Whether the district court's decision was final under Section 158D of the U.S. Code. That's an issue I know the courts encountered many times in the past. And briefly, we saw a jurisdictional issue. We raised it via motion to dismiss the appeals. And it appears to me that the issue boils down to, can the appellant, by stipulating that they won't contest the issues that the bankruptcy court still needs to decide before this contract can be assigned, namely, whether there's been a default, is there any cure amount owing, and is the assignee giving adequate assurance of future performance. The appellant has stipulated that they won't contest that, but the jurisdictional issue on finality is whether that transforms what I would suggest.
Well, why not? It makes perfectly good sense. Once the appellant says, "I'm not going to contest it," then there's no contest in the district court, so whatever he wants to do in the bankruptcy court, whatever he does, wants to, he does. So why isn't that ministerial? Something's uncontested is ministerial.
I think the answer is, Your Honor, as articulated by the Second Circuit in the Orion case that we cited, Section 365A of the Bankruptcy Code requires the bankruptcy court to approve such an alienation of bankruptcy estate property. And the function of the court is not simply to be the referee of a contest over that, but also to exercise judicial discretion in determining for itself
why,
that that's an appropriate...
If no one's contesting it, what's the point?
Well, the bankruptcy court serves a function of an overseer of the disposition of the assets.
The bankruptcy court resolves disputes between creditors. Right? That's what it does. If there's no dispute, there's nothing to resolve. What else would they do? Considering whether it's good for the United States to have... Well, they don't do that. They just resolve disputes.
Well, Your Honor, again, the Second Circuit in Orion said otherwise.
The Second Circuit said, give me a reason why it's a good thing to have bankruptcy judges saying, well, we don't have any dispute, but I'd like to make sure this is, you know, good for the country.
I think that's part of the function, Your Honor. I just think it's part of the function of a bankruptcy judge who's overseeing.
Why is that part of the function? Have a bankruptcy judge thinking about things that have nothing to do with bankruptcy?
Well, the disposition of the assets of the estate
that's
is the
a matter of the respective claims of creditors, right? And if the creditors all agree, you know, creditor X is entitled to this and that, what's the interest of the bankruptcy judge?
The interest of an overseer to satisfy himself
that
that's appropriate.
Who is affected if only creditors are involved and they all agree? Who else could be affected by this?
Nobody.
And what's the purpose of the bankruptcy judge worrying about something that can't affect anyone?
Well, Your Honor, the point of our jurisdictional issue that we raised is that it appears that we're venturing into how will the bankruptcy judge decide this hypothetical issue at this point when this issue comes back before him if the case is remanded to bankruptcy court. And
well, there's nothing to decide if no one's arguing.
Well, we're assuming no one will argue, and that's a...
But you say, well, look, you know, you guys agree on everything, but I like a fight, you know? I want you to duke it out so I can make a decision and get appealed and, you know?
I think it's a fight you're losing, but go ahead.
Well, it may be a foregone conclusion, but it's still an exercise of judicial discretion to approve the transfer under Section 365A.
Could you say it's a foregone conclusion? And because it's a foregone conclusion, we should spin out this litigation some more? Hasn't gone on long enough? We want more?
Well, Your Honor, as the prevailing party in the district court, we raised the issue because we felt we had to.
You're just stalling, right? Just stalling the conclusion of this litigation.
No, Your Honor.
Yes.
It's a good time to notice that your time has expired. You can get out of there.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Mr. O'Donnell. Ms. Itkin?
Thank you, Your Honors. May it please the Court, I'm Robin Itkin of Steptoe & Johnson on behalf of the purchasers. Your Honor, to address the question you were asking earlier, there is no general rule that says that a trademark license is not transferable.
No, look, I'm suggesting it's a very good rule to say that if the parties don't provide otherwise, the trademark license is not transferable because the danger is that the transferee will not maintain the quality of the trademark, and if a trademark doesn't maintain, you know, uniform quality, it's gone. So it's a very serious consequence for a trademark owner if there's a transfer of a license. So it makes sense to have a general rule that you can't have the transfer unless there's a provision to that effect.
Well, Your Honor, the case law that deals with this.
Now, give me a reason, not a case law. Why isn't that a good rule?
I respectfully disagree that that's not a good rule. It's not a good rule.
So tell me why it's not a good rule.
Because trademarks don't deal with that particular issue. Trademarks deal with the protection of the owner of the mark to make sure there's no confusion in the consumer marketplace about whose trademark that is. And under this contract.
That's too limited. A trademark product must maintain its quality. If it doesn't, which of course could harm consumers, they have expectations about the trademark. Now the quality deteriorates. Then the trademark is sacrificed. That's why you have this rule: you can't have assignments of trademarks in gross. That is, you can't assign the trademark apart from the assets that produce the trademark product. The thought is, well, if the assets go with it, well, then there's some assurance or likelihood that quality will be maintained. So that's important.
It is important, Your Honor. But all the case law looking at this, including the Midway decision, which was raised by opposing counsel.
Not all the case law. It's a confusion. But I'm just saying, why isn't the simple rule to say, yeah, if it's trademark, the license is not assignable. If you want to make it assignable, you have a provision in there. It says assignment.
Your Honor, I think it could be the other way as well. Contracts.
No, because the presumption is that trademark owners are very leery about assignment because they don't know where their trademark is going to end up being used by some fly-by-night. And the goodwill associated with the trademark will deteriorate if the trademark product is being produced by someone who's not, you know, scrupulous and well-resourced.
The facts of this case don't have that issue, Your Honor. The facts of this particular case is that...
No, the question is not the facts of the case. The question is, what's a good rule of contract law regarding trademark license assignments?
I understand.
And I'm saying the simplest rule is just to say... It's not assignable unless there's a provision which says it's assignable.
Well, Your Honor, all I can address that is to respectfully disagree that based on the case law.
But
and
give me
history,
a reason, not a case law.
Okay. The reasoning is that the trademark is something that, yes, that is supposed to be protected for the owner of the mark. But there are circumstances where that general rule doesn't apply, because if they're going to assign it to somebody who is, there's not a personal relationship under the contract, you have to look to the services that are being performed, which is what all the courts have said. You look to the services that are being performed, unless there's some specific rule or law that says you can't, it's otherwise assignable if the contract doesn't prevent it, especially if the services are not something that are unique and personal and that somebody else can do it.
That's what makes everything so complicated, right? Instead of simply asking, is there an assignment clause, you start asking about the nature of the services and the details of the contract, which is much simpler to have, to say, a default rule, no assignment unless assignment is authorized. That's the simplest thing in the world. Rather than getting into the details of what exactly this licensee's assignee is going to do and this, and it's going to spoil the trademark.
I think, Your Honor, in a perfect rule going forward, if that were the law, then the contract would probably deal differently. But.
Well, why don't we say it's the law? You say it's, if that's the we can achieve perfection, fine. Why don't we say that's the rule?
Well, Your Honor, I think under the circumstance of this case, it would not be appropriate.
Why not?
Not the rule, because this case.
Why didn't you? I mean, Blue, or you know, why not? Why didn't it say when it took out the trade, when it licensed, said, well, we'd like the right to be able to assign it.
I think the answer to that is, and with respect,
probably WGW said, no, we're not going to allow that. We don't know who you're going to assign it to.
Well, I think, Your Honor, the main thing here is there is no longer a license in this agreement. That expired a long time ago.
That's not according to your opponent, who says the trademark license kept going.
And I think that, I'm sorry, but that defies the plain language of the contract.
Well, the language he cites is, he says that, the Second Amendment provides, except as modified by this amendment and the First Amendment, it remains in full force and effect. And so he reads that to say that there was no expiration or termination of the sublicense.
Yes, and that's just incorrect, Your Honors. It's clear in 1.3 of the agreement, and Your Honors, by the way, it's A1177 through 1188 for your records, if you're still looking.
So we're looking at 1.3?
1.3 specifically says, WG will grant SJB a license effective during the remaining months of 2002. And that's with respect to the license.
Well, wait, what are we looking at?
The 1.3 of the agreement.
Amendment to the agreement?
No, the actual agreement.
What about the First Amendment?
The First Amendment, Your Honor, is very specific to apply to only extend. What it does is it's very specific, and I think the problem is people are taking it out of context and not looking at the category. It says on page 1, paragraph 1, January 1, 2003 to June 30, 2003. And it talks about that with respect to that period, they've extended the license of WG to Simply Blue. The license has been extended for those 6 months period, and that's it. It's very clear when you look at the next page, paragraph 2, in capital bold letters, says time period subsequent to June 30, 2003. And that says effective July 1, 2003, all the terms that would have commenced as of January 1, which is when the services commenced after the license terminated December 2002, are extended to July 1, 2003. And it's very clear because during that limited two-week license period, which was then continued for 6 months under the First Amendment, a license fee was paid by Simply Blue to Western Glove. After that period, which started January 1, 2003 under the agreement, and was extended 6 months under the First Amendment, there was no longer a license because there wasn't anything being performed that required a license. Now Simply Blue was conducting services for which Western Glove would pay Simply Blue a service fee. And all through the documents.
Services, but these services, didn't they include selling the jeans?
No, Your Honor. That ended with respect to the when the license ended. If you look, Your Honor, to paragraph 3.2. of the original agreement, A1178. Western Glove shall control and shall be financially responsible.
Wait, what page is this?
Sorry, it's page 2 of the agreement, and it's A1178 in the record.
Yeah, well, what paragraph?
Paragraph 3.2, under the year 2003. Okay. Western Gloves shall control and shall be financially responsible for all aspects of the production and sale of the trademarked apparel, including, by way of example, purchasing the apparel from SJB sources. Because now SJB was no longer able to sell it on its own, so Western Glove was buying all the inventory and all the purchase orders back from Simply Blue under this agreement, and that's above as well. They also will handle Western Glove purchasing the apparel, setting prices, approving the credit of prospective customers, importation, warehousing, shipping, distribution, invoicing, and collection of accounts. It had extreme control, and Simply Blue is merely a conduit or facilitator providing services to allow Western Glove on its own account to sell that trademarked apparel.
Why did WGW grant a two-week trademark license?
You know what, Your Honor? I have no idea. We really don't understand. But it's clear from the document that they first thought 2 weeks.
Why haven't you made it your business to understand?
Because when we've asked them why they granted it, and we haven't gotten an answer. It was something they arranged at the beginning for a limited period of time that were then turned into Simply Blue providing designs to Western Glove that Western Glove could decide whether it wanted to take or not, plus these other services that are set forth in 3.1.
So your position is it's more than just setting up how the money is paid or changing how accounts are paid?
Yes, Your Honor. And those amendments that dealt with how the accounts are paid, as opposing counsel stated, only deals with the service fee portion. It's it starts with July 2003 and forward, and specifically says throughout all those paragraphs, the service fee. There's nothing after that period that reflects back to a license, and specifically including the Second Amendment, which is A1183. The Second Amendment was executed in September 03, a couple months after the license period terminated in July 03. That amendment doesn't do anything to revive a license. It doesn't talk about a license. All it says is that for periods effective as of September 2003, the service fee payable will be done, calculated in different ways going forward. But there's nothing referencing back to a license because the license expired by the clear terms of the contract.
Okay. Thank you, Ms. Itkin.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Mr. Keach? So tell us, why would WGW issue a trademark license for 2 weeks?
As I said, Your Honor, quite frankly, the parties were in a trial period. As I understand it, and I have made it my business to know, these parties were frankly unsure of one another. And the nature of these series of amendments reflected the growth of the parties' relationship as to whether or not...
How could 2 weeks be an adequate trial period to determine the competence or bona fides of the respective parties?
Well, and I think, Your Honor, that there were business exigencies that led to the short period of time initially with respect to how that was going to be paid, and then the parties evolved their relationship.
Why could you learn in 2 weeks? I don't get it.
Well, I'm not suggesting I'm defending the wisdom of the time period. I'm only telling you what I understand from the clients was the reason for the shortness. And then they extended it for increasingly brief periods of time until they established the relationship.
Well, what about Ms. Itkin's argument that the trademark license, read the agreement with its amendments as a whole, that the trademark license expired after the 6 months?
Yeah, Your Honor, as I said, the critical language is 1.1 of the First Amendment, and I think what's actually important here...
But 1.1 of the First Amendment appears just to extend the license for 6 months, and the original agreement, as she pointed out, appears to terminate the license at the end of the two-week period. So whether it's 2 weeks or 6 months, it looks as if the license ends at that point.
Certainly, Your Honor. I don't think 1.1 does limit the license to 6 months. I think it limits the methodology of payment to the 6 months. Interestingly enough, the bankruptcy court and the district court both looked at this language and came to diametrically opposed conclusions about it.
2.1 says, WG hereby grants to SJB a non-exclusive license to sell women's jeanswear bearing the trademark United States And that ends on December 31st, 2002, and then the First Amendment extends it to the six-month period. And when the extension is over, why isn't that the end of the license?
Well, Your Honor, because 1-1 doesn't just extend the license for 6 months. I think it's critical here that, as I said, two courts looked at this, came to different conclusions. As we pointed out in our offer of proof, in securities filings with the SEC, Simply Blue, through its heart marks, its public company heart marks, stated unequivocally that this license was an exclusive trademark license. It said that in its SEC filings. And a press release that they issued to announce the stalking horse
agreement. Where in the First Amendment do you see anything that purports to extend the license?
Well, as I said, Your Honor, the best evidence of the party's intent is what they were calling it in their material that they were subjecting to the anti-fraud provisions. But what I would say as to 1-1 is the way they would like to read it and the way the district court would like to read it is that SJB shall continue to produce and sell trademarked apparel as a licensee of WG. They would like to then put an ellipse and go to the end and have it say through June 30th. We think the right way to read this provision is essentially to put either a comma or a period there, which is to say that they'll continue to produce and sell trademark apparel as a licensee, period. And then the paragraph talks about how they'll get paid for that through June 30th, and then the contract changes the way they'll get paid. That is, frankly, the only way to make sense of the agreements in order to allow Simply Blue to do what it must do. And that the fact that the parties saw it that way is amplified by the fact that if one looks at the extrinsic evidence that we made an offer of proof about below, the Simply Blue and all of its affiliates in its sworn SEC filings referred specifically to this agreement as a trademark licensing agreement. And a press release to announce the contract to sell to this purchaser, they called it a trademark licensing agreement. All of the parties felt this was a trademark licensing agreement. And I would point to the Compagnie Financière decision, then Judge Sotomayor's decision in the Second Circuit, where she pointed out when all of the extrinsic evidence goes one way and it's before the appellate court can look to that extrinsic evidence to clarify an ambiguity. If the fact that both of these courts below looked at this provision and came out to diametrically opposed views creates an ambiguity, I would submit that the only extrinsic evidence presented below, and which is before Your Honors, establishes unequivocally a license agreement.
You want a trial on whether the trademark license continued after June 30th, 2003, is that it?
I don't think it requires a trial, Your Honor, because, as I said, we made an offer of proof, and that's the only extrinsic evidence offered, and it all points to it being a trademark license. And what Compagnie Financière says and a number of the other decisions we cited says is that the appellate court can look at that undisputed, one-sided extrinsic evidence and decide for itself. What I would say, and this is reflected in the Delta Airlines decision, which is remarkably similar to this case. In the Delta Airlines case, the bankruptcy court looked at specific language, came out one way. The district court looked at specific language and came out another way. And the appellate court there said that's the very definition of ambiguity if one assumes that each is at least remotely plausible. That court didn't have undisputed one-sided extrinsic evidence and sent the case back for a trial to look at extrinsic evidence. What I would say, Your Honor, is that one of two things has to happen here, and we think the first is appropriate. We think that this court can affirm the bankruptcy court based on the undisputed one-sided extrinsic evidence plus what we think is its proper exegesis of the five documents. If that's not the case, what we have here is the classic definition of an ambiguity, and it ought to go back so that the bankruptcy court can look at that undisputed extrinsic evidence and make a finding. But we think
which party drafted this agreement?
Your Honor, I don't think it was one side or the other. I think, frankly,
it's put together by a committee. It looks like a committee.
Well, and I think, frankly, without the full assistance of counsel, Your Honor, I think a lot of these documents were done in-house.
Yeah, it looks like.
Okay, well, thank you very much,
thank
Mr.
you, Your Honor.
Peach, Mr. O'Donnell, Ms. Itkin.